Chapter 30. Killing an Ouroboran is hard, but I would argue that killing a linear mortal can often be harder, for you cannot simply prevent their birth in one life and have that serve as death for all. Each murder must be conducted each life, a matter as routine as brushing teeth or trimming nails. The key is consistency. It was 1951, and I was living in London. Her name was Rosemary Dorset. She was 21 years old and liked money. I was lonely and liked her. I won't pretend it was a profound relationship, but it was, in its own way, reasonably honest. I didn't ask for exclusivity, and she didn't attempt to extort, though she could see that I was a reasonably wealthy gentleman. Then one day she missed our meeting, and I went to her lodging and found her in the bath, wrists slashed. The police called it suicide, dismissing her as one more dead tart. But I looked, and I saw. The blade had gone too deep into her right wrist, slashing the tendons. She couldn't have been strong enough to hold it for the next cut on her left, and besides, there were no hesitation marks, no signs of doubt, no note, no shuffling around as she tried to get the angle right or worked up her courage. As someone practiced in the art of self-destruction, I knew a murder when I saw it. The police refused to investigate, so I took over. The evidence was sickeningly clear to find once you looked. Fingerprints, one even in the blood itself, and the madam downstairs had a list of all Rosemary's regulars and thought she'd seen one Richard Lyle leaving as she had come home. Getting his address was a matter of a few polite phone calls. Getting his fingerprints was a case of approaching him in a pub, buying him several pints and listening to his ramblings, which ranged from a discussion of fine art taken from a textbook to loud and raucously cheered remarks about the bloody packies and wogs. His voice was the overly slippery upper-class accent of a middle-class man with aspirations and elocution lessons. In 30 years, it would be a parody accent, used by comics to expose the sad cliché of the lonely man who believed that Ascot was sacred and could never quite get a ticket. In a merciful mood, I might have felt sorry for this little man, striving to be accepted by a portion of society that didn't just ignore him, it didn't even notice him knocking. Then I took his beer glass home and checked his prints, which matched the print in the blood on the side of the bath, and any sympathy I might have felt was gone. I sent my evidence, beer glass, analysis of the blood patterns, the fingerprint in the blood, to Scotland Yard, to a detective called Cutter, who had a reputation for imagination and prudence. He interviewed Lyle 2 days later, and that, from what I could tell, was the end of it. 2 days after that, another prostitute hanged herself, and there were self-defense marks on her wrists and arms, chloral hydrate in her bloodstream. This time, though, warned by the visit from the police, Lyle had been careful and left not a fingerprint behind. I had not committed murder at the time, although I had killed. By this point, I knew of 7 men I had killed directly, 6 of them in the Second World War, and 1 in self-defense. I also calculated that I had contributed to the deaths of many hundreds more through acts as banal as fixing the wheel on a B-52 or proposing a more reliable timer which could later be used on a bomb. I considered whether I had the courage to commit actual cold-blooded murder and concluded with mild regret that I did. I informed myself that I had the decency to be ashamed, but what little comfort that was compared to the certainty that I would commit this act. I would kill Richard Lyle. I prepared carefully. I bought a boat under an assumed name for cash in hand, a crabby tin thing with a lower deck that stank of the slick white fungus which infested its walls. I bought petrol and food, hydrochloric acid and a hacksaw, careful to spread my purchases over as wide an area as possible. I bought gloves and rubber overalls, examined the tides on the Thames and observed the traffic in the night. I acquired several cc's of benzodiazepine and rented a room opposite the pub, where I had first acquired Richard Lyle's fingerprints. I waited until one night, a Tuesday, the smog thick green over the streets, when he came to have a drink, and went in. I joined him, remembering our old acquaintance and asking how he had been. He was gleeful, happy, a gleam of sweat about his face and a loudness in his speech that at once set alarm bells ringing in my mind. What had he done to induce such delight? I examined him, every part, for a sign of something amiss, and smelled the fresh soap in his hair, saw how scrubbed his nails were, how fresh and clean his clothes were, despite the settling lateness of the hour. and knew, with that irrational part of the mind that rationality always denies, that I'd come to him a few hours too late. Rage flared up inside me, and briefly my plan was forgotten, my efficient, organized scheme. I still smiled and smiled, and we staggered out together into the coal-hung air at closing time, hanging off each other, best of friends, our skin smeared black by the air we breathed. But as we staggered away up the street, one of those lingering terraced streets of tiny houses that still hid beneath the craters of the East End, he looked up at the sky and laughed, and I punched him, and punched him again, and when he fell, I straddled him, grabbing him by the throat and screamed, "Where is she? Who was it this time?" and punched him again. In the rush of adrenaline, in my rage, smothered by the smog and hidden by the dark, all my plans, my careful, reasoned plans, were forgotten. I barely felt the shock against my knuckles as I drove my fists into his skull. Nor did I register the flick knife that he drove up through my abdomen and into the bottom of my left lung until, drawing breath for another strike, I realized I had no breath to draw. His face was jelly, but I was dead. He pushed me off him, and I fell like soggy pudding into the gutter, the dirty water flecking my face. He crawled over to me, his breath wheezing, blood popping and bubbling out of the end of his shattered nose. Awareness of the knife in his hand gave me an awareness of what he did with it, so I felt the next three strokes as he drove it into my chest. Then I felt nothing at all.